Ready for an amazing deal? Breezeline's fiber-powered internet starting at $19.99 per month offers the reliability you deserve and security you can trust. Whether you're streaming, gaming, or working from home, we've got all your needs covered with speeds up to 1 gig and our 2-year price lock guarantee. This deal gets even better with 2 free months of internet, free equipment, and free Wi-Fi your way to protect against cyber threats. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires July 8th, 2024. Learn more at breezeline.com.
Welcome to a special bonus episode of Pod Save America. I'm John Favreau.
I'm John Lovett. And now I'm Tommy Vitor. That was just me. He's not here. Tommy's not here. But he's here for the episode, but not for the recording of the introduction to the bonus episode.
So we were at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas on Tuesday. And we had a wonderful discussion with...
Kara Swisher.
Friend of the pod. Has her own pod on Recode.
And so we did a crossover. You know, there were laughs. There were some tough questions.
Lovett and Kara are fast friends now.
Yep, we're doing a little road show.
We hope you enjoy the episode. And here it is.
So we were just sitting backstage, and we were talking about a variety of things, of podcasts. And I'm so excited, coming from Silicon Valley, to be able to interview white men. I'm so excited, first of all.
Big switch.
Yeah, it's a big switch for me. It's usually, you know, not the sausage fest that's happening here. But let's get started into what you guys are doing.
When do we come on?
When do you come on? All right, here we go. We're going to start about sort of what you're doing exactly.
Sure.
So why don't you explain what you're doing? Because you've created several podcasts,
yeah,
but you're creating a media company, essentially a left-wingy media company, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
John, why don't you start?
So we had a podcast called Keeping It 1600 before the election. All right. Then Trump won, and we decided that we didn't just want to continue the podcast, which we may have done if Hillary had won, but we wanted to get back into the game to some extent. We'd all been in politics for a long time, and so we wanted to not only continue the political podcast we were doing, but expand to a network of podcasts, expand into video, sort of create a progressive media company that didn't just analyze politics like we did during Keeping It 1600, but also helped inspire activism and organize. So we started Crooked Media, and we're in the very early stages, so we have a long way to go.
But
we hope to be a progressive media company that informs, entertains, and inspires action.
So progressive media companies have had not the best history. I'm thinking Air America, and we got Rachel Maddow and Al Franken, and others out of that. But it wasn't a successful effort. Same thing with Current, others, things. How do you guys look at this idea of it? What are you thinking?
Oh, well, first, I don't compare myself to those things.
Well, good idea.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think we're approaching this thing like how do we build a successful progressive company. I think we're starting from a simple idea of we want to have this no bullshit conversation about politics. It's resonated with people. There's a huge appetite for a different kind of conversation that, you know, look, we're figuring this out as we go, right? We decided to launch and build it as we go because we just wanted to start talking. We want to be part of this conversation. But one thing that is for certain is that there are tens of millions of people who are deeply unsatisfied with the way they get their political news. I mean, the way that we were thinking about it is that, like, you turn on cable news and there's, like, a ton of great journalists, but what you end up watching is world-class journalists interviewing morons. And, like, that's not a sustainable system. It is not a sustainable system. We all fucking hate the news. We turn it on. It makes us feel bad. The content is pretty bad. The way it's delivered is worse. And, you know, 2016, what? They're laughing at me already.
No, we got loose really fast.
By the way, guys,
start going. That means
everybody whose flights were canceled, thank you for being here. You're part of our key demographic. People stuck at the airport. A group of people with which we're competing with CNN. What was the question? So we're going to do that.
Basically, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah. So look, we're starting
with... Good question.
You know, we started with this podcast. It resonated with a lot of people. We're going to try to figure out ways to bring that kind of a voice, a younger, more authentic voice. You know, all these different news outlets are all struggling with how to reach people, and so many seem to have settled on having a serious voice of authority with none of the actual authority behind it. And we just want to sound like ourselves. We want to bring people who know something about politics, who have something to say, who care about these issues, mm-hmm. and aren't going to be part of a stilted, dead language conversation that we're all very sick of.
Well, I'm not sure if it was authoritative. It's screamy. It's just pretty
yes.
screamy.
Yes.
Right.
For sure. That's also bad.
So, Tommy, you guys were at Bill Simmons, The Ringer and stuff, and that's where you got started with Keeping It 1600. Why did you leave? Because that's that's what he is doing. So why not be part of that particular media organization?
Sure. I mean, there's a couple of reasons. One is, I think that if Hillary had won, we probably would have kept doing this as a hobby. Mm-hmm. But when she lost, I think we all had this existential crisis that if you watched the live stream, you saw happen in real time, where we figured we have to. It didn't feel right to wake up every day and obsess about politics and what's happening in the country and then go to work doing something else. For me, I needed to marry those two things up and make that my job and my life. And
never watch that live stream, by the way.
No, it's great. Watch us break down.
It's really sad.
Yeah.
It's really sad. So I think what The Ringer is doing is great, but it's sports and culture and news. We're trying to make something that's very progressive and very activist. Mm-hmm. And then another end, we're dedicating our lives to this. I'm moving down to LA, we're starting an office, we're hiring a team. We want to own and have the flexibility of creating all the content and making all the decisions.
But you were the big hit on that, correct? You were the big hit on The Ringer, correct?
Those are your words.
Yes.
No, I've been reading Bill Simmons for a decade. His stuff is great, and it always will be great. And
right.
The Ringer is going to be fine.
Were they sharing revenue with you? I understand they were not sharing revenue with you.
Were paying us dollars.
Yeah. Okay, but enough dollars?
They were paying us.
Do you want us to get the contract out?
Yes, please. That would be great.
They were paying us enough for what was a part-time hobby.
A part-time thing.
And so
but you guys wanted to start your own thing.
We wanted to do a full-time thing.
So are
and
you?
And we said that, and I said to Bill right after the election, we want to start our own thing because we want to not just be partisan, but also activist. And I don't think you want all of this activism under the banner of The Ringer, which also does sports and tech and stuff. And he's like, yeah, I totally understand.
We want to do stuff with this company that will have a political benefit that might not have any financial benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think explaining that to someone if you're part of a broader organization would be difficult. I think we can have that flexibility doing it.
But you want to build a business, correct? I mean,
yeah.
that's what
yeah.
you're going for.
Absolutely.
And you're one of the top ones on iTunes. I mean, I'm in the podcast business. You can make some money. You can mm-hmm. actually make some real money at it. So are you raising money right now?
We're not.
I don't think we need to.
Not raising money?
Nope.
How are you going to pay?
We're not going to pay ourselves any money, but we're going to use the revenue from ads to invest in the business and try to hire a great team and mm-hmm. get an office.
So you're not going sort of the startup route, creating that kind of.
Well, I just feel like the podcast is our seed money.
Right.
I mean, I don't know the venture fund terms. The vultures are emailing us, and I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Right,
I don't know what a seed round is.
Seeds.
I want nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
You guys are way, way too eager.
Right.
And I was like, we don't need you people. We're making money hand over fist.
Right, yeah.
There it is.
Which is very against the
people start. Say that making money in the content media game is hard, and that is just not my experience.
I agree with you. I agree with you.
It's honestly a joke. It's super confusing because everyone's like, oh, how are you going to monetize? It's easy.
Yeah.
Just start talking and then the money rolls in.
Don't tell them.
I don't know what other people are doing.
Yeah.
So clearly we're not raising money.
Okay, all right, good. Because you're not very good.
You can give us money. It's going to be a terrible valuation for you.
Yeah. What is your valuation, John? Obviously, for you, priceless in your head, but what is it?
I mean, I'm going to have to say it, guys. Right. Billion-dollar business, hub of the resistance. What do you want?
All right, okay. So let's talk about the resistance, because
people say you're a very tough interview.
I don't. John,
do you find that?
John, I do find that. I do find it, but I really do enjoy. it's easier when I have to interview egomaniacs.
Yes.
There she is.
Great. That was great.
There she is.
Oh, I feel so good about
you
that.
You do.
That was really good.
I made Mark Zuckerberg sweat and almost faint.
Really?
Yeah. And the only reason I stopped is because I thought he would fall on the ground, that I'd have to do CPR, and then that picture would go down. And you just don't want that to
weighing
happen.
The options.
I didn't want any lip action with Mark Zuckerberg.
Dear Max.
Anyway, dear Max, yeah.
You won't believe what happened with Kara today. I'm trying to build a world where that doesn't happen again.
In any case, let's get to Trump, speaking of making it happen appropriately.
How's this going?
Speaking of egomaniacs.
Speaking of egomaniacs. So Trump, even though, you guys, I did watch you on election night where you were weeping copiously in real time. one could say Trump has been very, very good to you at this point, because it's a really good time. It feels like that with us and our site, and a lot of media people are suddenly activated. And I hate to use that word, but it does feel like that. I mean, the other day, George Stephanopoulos actually got angry, and I didn't know what to do with myself, because I was like, wow, you're asking a real question that needs an answer, rather than softer stuff. So talk about what you feel the opportunity is now with the resistance, when you talk about the resistance.
I mean, I would easily trade the podcast and everything we're doing for Trump not being president right now.
All right, okay.
But look, no, I think he's... I don't think there's too many silver linings of this election, but what we have at least seen over the last couple months is that it has spurned a level of activism and engagement and interest in politics that I haven't seen since the early days of 07 and 08 when Obama started running. And even then, you know, I mean, because this is people who, we are talking to people and people are coming up to us that have never paid attention to politics before or have just sort of casually paid attention to politics before. And now they're saying, I'm scared. I want to know what to do. I want to fix it. What should I do? Where should I go? And you're seeing these people show up at town halls, and you're seeing them show up at rallies, and you're seeing them march. And so if that movement can come out of this, and you know, we can survive the Trump presidency and people can be engaged, then you know, that's a very good thing for democracy.
And how do you feel about that?
I think that's right. We're in the middle of a national crisis. There's a lot of people who are scared and worried and are either people who've paid attention to politics and have never been more engaged, or the kind of person that wasn't paying attention. Either way, they're showing up at protests, they're showing up at airports, they're trying to figure this out, and there's so much coming at us. There's so much crazy stories, and so it's so hard to figure out what to trust. It's so hard to know, you know, so often you turn on the news and there's so little sense of history, so you have to find out, like, wait, is what Trump's doing today, is this normal? Does this just seem bad, or is this what, like, firing U.S. attorneys, is that something that happens every time? Well, yes. Did they do it the normal way? No. It's kind of weird. It's kind of not weird. And there's so much coming at us. There's so much to parse. If we can play some small role in saying, hey, you know, look, we've been there. We've worked in politics. We can get the people that we trust that are really smart to help us figure this out. Like, that's a role I'm, like, proud to be a part of, and it'll be a small part of that, and bring on people who can say, here's what you can do. I know you want to help. I know you've never done that before. I know you've never been to a protest before. You've never been to a town hall before. This is great group, Indivisible. You know, we're talking to them because they're new and they're trying to figure this out. You should go to their website. Go be a part of what they're doing.
So when you're thinking about this, Tommy, when it comes to concept around getting people activated and getting people doing things, a lot of comparison made to the Tea Party, that sort of the left Tea Party. Do you see that? Do you imagine that? Because they are super effective.
They were very effective. They were very organized. I think they're tactics that you can borrow in terms of organizing, in terms of being present, in terms of just remembering how easy it is as citizens and constituents to scare the shit out of Congress. Because that pressure works, and it works fast, and it caved quickly, as we're seeing on ACA repeal. You know, I think, like, we are part of a group of organizations that is riding a wave of interest in Trump. And we approach this business with some humility because we're aware of that. But I think what Lovett was saying earlier, like, A, there's a cathartic effect to, like, when everyone around you, you're watching this thing happen, you feel like it's crazy, and you're like, do you guys see this too? I think hearing people who've worked in the White House and done what we did, like, is a helpful reminder that, no, you're not crazy. Like, what's happening is, and we're part of that.
So do you feel, now you all worked in the Obama administration, do you feel like you're utter failures of what's happened?
That never occurred to me.
Because a lot of ways, like, I want to get to the idea of, like, every morning things change and stuff like that, but this is a reaction in a way, and it is a failure
fashion. Listen,
you personally feel
I'm going to be, like, the reflexive, defensive Obama guy, and it's encoded in my DNA, and I can't fix that. But I think elections are unique events that are about one individual versus another individual. I don't think you can blame everything on a predecessor in any election.
We should thank God that Trump took office with relative peace and prosperity and not in the middle of a crisis like when Obama took office, because God help us if we were in the middle of a crisis right now and Trump took over. I mean, like, I think Obama accomplished quite a bit in two terms, right?
What do you attribute the reaction to? Because even if you can say Hillary's the worst candidate or she wasn't like it, whatever the fuck you want to say about Hillary in that part, it got really way too close, given.
For sure.
Years. It got way too close, no matter who was the candidate.
For sure. Yes. little things had to go wrong for Donald Trump to become president. Mm-hmm. Comey, emails, all that stuff. But big things did make Trump possible. Big cultural, political, economic forces mm-hmm. opened the door to someone like Trump. You know, Barack Obama took office in the middle of a massive financial crisis. He was handed a bunch of messes all around the world and at home. Mm-hmm. You know, we spent the 8 years doing a lot of good work from, you know, rebuilding the economy, the stimulus, getting into healthcare, Wall Street, all the different things that amount to an incredibly successful legislative and administrative period of time. That being said, like, didn't solve every problem in the world, and there are long-term trends that are really difficult to address. You know, one of the things, you know, we talked to Seth Moulton yesterday, mm-hmm. and, you know, we asked him sort of like, you know, look, there's this anger, there's this angst about the economy. You know, who do you see talking about the new economic vision? What should Democrats be saying? And the thing that he said, which I actually find, I actually think it's a little bit inspiring, like, we're figuring that out now. You know, that if this election does one thing, it shows us that, like, when the center left, the center right, when they're not offering answers, it opens the doors to monsters. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happened here.
One in five Trump voters gave Obama a positive approval rating. Mm-hmm. Job performance when they went to the polls.
Sure.
So this was, first of all, when you've been in office for 8 years, right, there is a feeling of people want change, right? And at the end of the day, if you had a positive image of Hillary Clinton, you voted for her. If you had a positive image of Trump, you voted for him. If you didn't like either candidate, which was about 20% of voters, they voted for Trump by about 17 points. Mm-hmm. Because he was the outsider that they didn't like versus what Hillary Clinton was, which is the insider they didn't like, right? And so there's a lot of complicating factors, but in the end, it's that simple. It was sort of a change. It ended up being a change election.
Just to change things. See, I think it was much more dramatic than that. That it was things people didn't see.
I think that, no, I think
but
that
for the casual observer, I'm saying right. a lot of people who go to the polls at the end of the day do not pay attention to politics as closely as we all pay attention to politics mm-hmm. because they're busy, they lead busy lives, and so they sort of look at it from afar. And when you squint and look at the whole thing from afar, you say, he's sort of crazy, but he's an outsider, so maybe he can bring change. She, I don't know if I like her, but she's been there forever, so I'll give him a chance. And that tipped the election because mm-hmm. it was that close.
But I think it is really important for Democrats, for liberals, to ask what weren't they getting, right? Mm-hmm. What did they want to be different? Like, what are the economic policies that were either not describing well or not offering? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a conversation that's ongoing. It's a really important thing. You know, we're right now really Democrats feel united because we're united against a terrible foe. But as we move forward, it's going to become more and more important for us to have a positive vision. What?
Right. Terrible foe.
Terrible foe. What do you want? A great and historic villain. Okay. Evil rises in the East. I don't know what else to say.
Hey, don't go anywhere. This is Pod Save America, and there's more on the way.
I'm Roman Mars, host of 99% Invisible. I love the book, The Power Broker, the epic biography of former New York City planner Robert Moses. So I'm breaking it down 100 pages at a time and talking to special guests about why this book matters, like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I actually think if it wasn't for Robert Moses, I probably wouldn't have run for Congress.
Listen to 99% Invisible's breakdown of The Power Broker every month on the 99% Invisible podcast feed.
You can live out your MasterChef dreams when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Why are smart businesses graduating to NetSuite by Oracle? Because NetSuite eliminates the expense of multiple business systems by consolidating your operations together into one. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite reduces IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, so you can access it from anywhere. You cut the cost and headaches of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Bringing all your major business processes into one platform improves efficiency, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. You'll see how you'll profit with NetSuite, too. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Just go to netsuite.com/podcast25 for more information. That's netsuite.com/podcast25.
it's rather easy to play against Trump as the villain. What fresh hell has he done today?
Right.
Essentially,
yeah.
Like, the other day I was saying to someone, I went to the shower and he did something while I was in the shower. I'm like, fuck, I missed the episode. Like,
that's exactly right.
I think he fired Sally Yates. I was like, how did he do that so quickly? But we can't. You can't always be against. The villain is always the appealing character. You think about just drama. You all live in You live in San Francisco, but Los Angeles. It's easy to have an appealing villain, essentially,
right.
Which is, I think, what this has been turned into. It's another thing to have a message. And one of the things that I think was problematic for the Clinton campaign is a lot of people, both on the coastal elites, really did make fun of Make America Great Again. I thought it was a great slogan. I thought, wow, that is a really good slogan. It makes it's very appealing, makes you feel good and bad at the same time. It makes you feel like you want to do something. And then when I saw Stronger Together, it felt like a glue commercial. To me, I was like, oh, okay, we're stronger together. Like, it didn't like get you. What is the message for the Democratic Party? And then I want to get into all Trump all the time. Like, yeah, how do you guys cover this? What do you think about how he's doing and stuff like that? But where is the message? Because you all were involved in messaging. Like, the message?
This is the nature of politics, that for the last 8 years, the message of the Republican Party was Obama sucks and we're not Obama.
Right.
And that led them to victory in the House, the Senate, and the presidency.
Yeah.
It did.
Yeah.
You know? Now, I do not agree that we should just do the same thing and for the next 8 years and say we're not Trump, because I do think you need a positive message.
Right.
I think what was tough for Hillary and what was tough for that campaign is just what you were saying, which is you go out there, you give a big speech on the jobs and the economy, and then suddenly the Access Hollywood tape comes out, right? And the next day, she can't go do another event on jobs and the economy because no one's covering that because Trump just said this crazy thing, right? Mm-hmm. And so everyone, the Clinton campaign excluded, kept getting sucked into the vortex of Trump, right? And so I think as we look to 2018 and 2020, there is going to be a temptation because Trump is going to continue to do and crazy things and tweet crazy things every single day to just make your message every day about what he did.
Right.
But what you have to do is talk about jobs, the economy, healthcare, and your positive vision for all of this.
There's a broader problem here, which is if you look at the research of like how people and parties define themselves for the first time in history, Democrats are more defined by being opposed to the other than anything they stand for. And I think we need to do a lot of work figuring that out again.
So what do they stand for? Because I don't know.
It's an ongoing message challenge. I mean, economic equality, healthcare, civil rights. I mean, these are stringing these together into a core message is something that I don't think happened sufficiently the last round.
What do you think they stand for?
Well, I think, first of all, this is one of the lessons. You know, Kellyanne Conway, who I'm obviously a huge fan of, love her work, especially her, you know, I'm a more fan of her early work. I don't like the recent stuff. She said this thing, and it actually, to me, is still the smartest thing anyone simply said about the election, which is there's a difference between what offends you and what affects you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I think Bernie Sanders understood. I think that's something we instinctively understood, but it was really hard to cut through with all the Trump nonsense,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, stronger together, love Trump's hate. These are about kind of values and how things feel and how things look.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed to make that next step, and we need to make that next step into, you know, it's not just that Trump is conducting business at Mar-a-Lago, mm-hmm. you know, and being bribed to do it. Mm-hmm. It's that's going to hurt you. It's going to affect the decisions he makes. And I think coming back to, on the one hand, like how Trump's policies actually hurt people and not get dragged into the vortex of his bullshit
mm-hmm.
is going to be really hard. And then on the other side, I think we're not going to have the answer here today. What's the Democratic message? Democrats have lost elections up and down the board. We have to figure it out. It's a really hard problem.
I also think you can't start from the question of what's the message, what's the slogan. You have to answer the big question. And the big question right now is that neither party has answered is how in a global economy do we live together and thrive together and make sure that everyone has a chance to succeed? And where's the next generation of jobs going to come from? And as we become a more diverse nation, how do we make sure that we can live together and you know, not always demonize each other, right? And so there's questions of where opportunity comes from, where's prosperity comes from, how do we ensure some basic level of decency and equality in the society? And once we come up with those answers, then you can sort of tell a story that leads to a slogan, that leads to a message, right? right? Like, make America great again only worked because that was actually the, he told the whole story that went with that slogan.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
It was a story that we didn't agree with. And I, you know, I think it's a story that's in many ways wrong because he mischaracterizes where the country is, but there was a story to fit it, right?
What was interesting was the reaction though to that, which I found interesting. It's like, it is great. And it's like, that's not really a reaction. Yeah. It's great. It's really great. You know what I mean? It seems sort of like the irritating person at school. You know what I mean? Like, but you're wrong. And I think a lot of left spends a lot of time being righteously indignant. Well, like, yeah. I can't believe he said that. And about the 40th time, you're like, he fucking said it. Like, he said it, and he said it again, and he said it again.
Well, look, I think you can make an argument why America is great. I think you should certainly make that argument. But you have to flesh out that argument.
But then you're arguing
with him. You can't
just
make fun of it.
You also can't make fun of it, and you're arguing, you're on his agenda almost consistently.
Right.
Almost consistently, yeah. All Democrats do is react.
And that's the story of the entire election.
Yeah. It's like, what? I can't believe he said that. I'm like, he said it.
Right. No. Yeah, I feel like on the far right, they have this sort of vicious anger and hate. And on the left, we have our version, which is just incredibly annoying sanctimony.
Yeah.
And like high alert for sanctimony.
Right, right.
All over Twitter. I don't know if you've noticed.
Yeah, so yeah, I've noticed. So, yeah. Now it's getting funny, actually. It's getting really funny, which is what you guys are using.
Dear sir.
Dear sir.
How dare you?
How dare you?
No, sir, that is not what America represents. Like, how many more elections are we going to lose like this?
Love It probably has so many tweets like this.
Who does?
Go find him.
Oh, yeah. World-class hypocrite.
I'm going to get to Trump in a second, but what Democrats do have one sense of humor are just going to pile through. Which ones do you see? How do you look at the Democrats?
Looking at
you. This is
like the, you like what? Like who we
who
like?
Do you like? Who do you like?
Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Seth Moulton, who we talked to yesterday.
Jason Kander.
I mean, there's...
And that's not a... There's a lot of great people out there that we're not going to...
What do you like about
them?
So I'm big on people who talk like...
Only one that doesn't feel like a non-carbonated beverage is Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, well, so what? I'm very big on...
We call them non-carbonated... You're like,
oh. Oh, you mean like they're not bubbly?
Yeah.
Right.
Something.
Okay.
You know...
Let it go, love it. Let it go.
Effervescent.
I want to understand it.
It's non-carbonated.
I get it. No, I'm now getting it. I just didn't. Wasn't. I was. They're not carbonated.
Right. Okay.
All right. Go on. How do you guys think this is going?
I am very big on politicians who talk like normal human beings.
Yeah.
Like what?
And I think like all some of the people we just mentioned.
Like Bernie.
We had Congressman Seth Moulton on yesterday, and he spoke like we're speaking right now. He did not do the talking points up, here's my America. Like, he just didn't do any of that stuff, right? And Jason's like that. And Elizabeth Warren is certainly like that.
Yeah.
Kamala Harris is like that, you know? So I think there is a good group of Democrats. But I think sometimes as Democrats, we think about like resume and where you're from and who's the perfect person on paper and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I think that's a mistake. I think you just need to, like, I always say that after the 2004 election, when John Kerry lost, because everyone said he was too elitist and aloof and all that kind of stuff, everyone said, well, we lost the white working class, and so the answer is someone that has to connect with the white working class. We need a Southerner. We need a populist, right? If you had told someone after the 2004 election that the answer to the Democratic Party's white working class problem was a black guy from the south side of Chicago named Barack Hussein Obama, they would have told you were fucking crazy. Mm-hmm. But like 4 years later, he was president,
and
right?
And the same thing with Trump.
And exactly. And so people like Barack Obama and Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders and Michelle Obama, who all come from very different backgrounds, what they've all had in common is when they speak and communicate, they're very comfortable in their own skin, right? They are not, they don't speak in a lot of bullshit. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's important as we're looking. And look, I think the person who wins in 2020, wins the Democratic nomination, we might not have any idea who that is yet, especially in this kind of world. But as we're looking for leaders who rise, I'm looking for people who talk like normal human beings talk.
Mm-hmm. All right, what do you guys think?
I mean, I think John sort of articulated our belief as a show here, but I agree that, you know, I worked for John Edwards in 2004, and that was the perfect example of like a resume-based candidate, right? Like good-looking Southern guy that could appeal to XYZ state, and that's, if you think like that, you wind up with like an Evan Bayh or a John Edwards. It's just not going to connect with people.
Although I think he got real interesting quick, and if he had pushed that other stuff first, I would have been like, I'm down with you.
Yeah, I mean, the 04 race, that was pre... all the worst stuff.
Okay.
Oh, man, John Edwards, huh?
Yeah.
That took a turn.
Who do you like?
I mean, look, we talk about this all the time. I think we agree on this. I like those. I like our list.
Do you like any of the tech leaders or business leaders? Do you feel like President Mark Zuckerberg is a good idea?
You know what? Let's talk about that for a second.
All right.
Yeah. Oh, I'm
here's the thing.
To...
I don't know what's going on over there, but Mark Zuckerberg has a great story to tell. He built a pretty impressive company.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why he sounds like a senator in his fourth term. Like, just talk, man. Like, don't be so afraid. Like, that's the lesson. Trump is president. Say whatever you want.
Right.
Anyone can say whatever they want.
I worry that people are going to take from this, oh, if that billionaire celebrity outside of politics can run for president, so can I.
They all are saying it.
They all are saying that. But, like, it's about the personality. Mm-hmm. It's not about the resume. Mm-hmm. And, like, if there is a tech leader who goes out there and just, you know, has a no bullshit conversation with the American people about what we need to do, then yeah, maybe they have a shot.
But like,
the Zuckerberg thing is like, they are so cautious. The statements are cautious. Mm-hmm. Everything is calculated. It does. It sounds so Washington right now. Maybe it'll change. Maybe his listening tour will change.
And like, you know, like, they were talking about immigration and they put out such a overworked, you know, and they have good, right? They have good people, but but somehow it comes from the top, and you end up with something so overworked and so precious, and that doesn't say anything. It's like, what are you doing here? Right. Trump is president. You got to say things.
Right. Well, it's very hard to get them to, which is really amazing. It's
the other thing, though, is like, I also worry that there's this sense where you can apply tech to any problem, and that's how we're going to solve it. Like, if I hear someone say that we're going to hack the refugee crisis, I'm going to lose my fucking mind. Right. These are very complicated problems involving human beings and governments and, like, moral questions. Yeah. It's not that easy.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, that sort of...
Well, they kind of gotten their heads handed to them around the fake news stuff or hoaxes. I'm using the term hoaxes because the fake news word has gotten so bad.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah. Hoaxes. They're just hoaxes. And I think one of the things that's been hard is that the response of, you know, Mark, as usual, initially started like, we have no impact on anything.
Right.
Like, I don't know what you're talking about. We're a benign platform. And it's sort of that, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people kind of attitude.
Right.
And I'm like, actually, bullets kill people, but technically. but which you make.
Fake news kills people.
Sort of. Like, it doesn't. But it was interesting, the shift of we're just benign platforms and we're here to help the world versus you have consequences to your actions. And I think the penny is starting to drop. And Mark did start with a 6,000-word essay, which could have used a lot of editing. But in that zone, like, okay, maybe, possibly, we have an impact.
Right. It's just like, we're not a media company. Well, you're something new, and you're kind of both, and you have a really important role to play, and you can't pretend you don't.
Yeah. So let's talk about Trump.
Sure.
Trump, because we love talking about
it. Love it.
How do you guys feel about Obamacare and the repeal and Trump Care or Obamacare Lite? How are you looking at that?
Seems to be going swimmingly.
Yeah.
No, I think what's happening right now is Republicans and Donald Trump are reckoning with the fact that they told their base lies about Obamacare for the last 8 years, and now they're the dogs who caught the car. Mm-hmm. And the Congressional Budget Office, which is a bunch of nonpartisan nerds who crunch numbers, you know, came out yesterday and said that it would leave 24 million people uninsured. And it also said that it'll raise premiums, and then premiums will finally start to come down in 2026, but only because older people won't be able to afford health insurance.
Right.
And so because the older, sicker people are uninsured, then premiums might come down for other people.
After they die.
So basically, like, the plan is, like, if you're, like, a near retiree and you don't want to go bankrupt before you get Medicare, like, wrap yourself in some, like, bubble wrap. Stay very calm. Try not to eat healthy.
But the problem is...
Race.
They tried to make Obamacare this... Oh, it's a government takeover, it's socialized medicine, death panels, all these hoaxes, conspiracy theories. And the truth is that Obamacare was a rather conservative version of universal health care. Mm-hmm. Borrowed ideas from Mitt Romney, from the Heritage Foundation, individual mandate, all of these policies that people on the right had been talking about for years. And so because they branded it as this, like, government takeover thing, even though it really wasn't, now that they're trying to fix it, there's nowhere further to go on the right except to say the government doesn't have any responsibility to insure people. And their base, like, Donald Trump is not president because a lot of people wanted to lose their health care. That's not why. In fact, when he ran for president, he promised he wouldn't cut Medicaid. That promise is already broken with this bill. He promised he would cover everyone. He had insurance. That promise is already broken. And he's been very successful in lying to people and gaslighting people and stuff. But once people start to get these cancellation notices, if this passes, or once people realize that they can't afford to get their health care anymore, like, he's not going to be able to lie his way through that. That's going to be felt.
So what do you imagine is going to happen now? with, I mean, the media has been super aggressive on it, but every time the media does this, then it, oh, he wins, that kind of thing. It is, in that way, it is like a game.
Well, he's never been president before.
Right, right.
And this is the first thing he's tried to pass.
Right.
Remember, everything else up till now has been executive orders. This is the first thing he's actually tried to pass through Congress since he's been president.
I mean, it's interesting. We'll see if he commits to this, right? Because every once in a while he gets up there and he's like, I tell Paul Ryan and the gang that we should just let it all crash and burn for 2 years and get the political consequences, the benefits. But that's not right, so let's push this bill. As he reads coverage of how bad this bill is, as he sees Republicans start peeling off, I wonder if he'll stay committed to pushing this through. Because I don't know that, it's not clear to me what the constituency is for what they're trying to do, besides Paul Ryan's stupid PowerPoint and his Better Way nonsense.
I mean, look, so first of all, you saw even Breitbart today is kind of churning on the bill.
Yeah, that was interesting. They published the Paul Ryan.
Yeah, so I don't know what's going on. They're playing, it's like, I don't know, it's a bunch of idiots playing chess. I'm not really sure what's going on over there. Like, it's like, well, we're playing chess, but we don't really know the rules. But I also don't know the rules.
Gotcha.
Well, they're turning on each other.
Yes. Who knows? You see Republicans in the Senate say this bill can never pass. You know, Tom Cotton in the Senate says, why would the Republicans walk the plank on this bill? It can never pass the Senate. There's the Venn diagram of like the bill needs to be evil enough to pass the House and bad enough and give enough tax cuts to the rich and restrict the subsidies enough to pass the House. But then it also needs to be reasonable enough and moderate enough to get through the Senate. There may not be an overlap there. So
the numbers are 3 and 22. The Republicans, if they lose 22 House members, they can't pass in the House. If they lose 3 senators, they can't pass in the Senate. So you could imagine maybe Paul Ryan getting enough Republican congressmen to vote for the bill, either the way it is now by Trump browbeating them, or by making it, like Levitt said, even further to right. But even if that happens, there's now 8 Republican senators who've gone on record in the Senate having problems with the bill, right? And they can only lose 3, so it's tough. But I do think, this happened during the campaign, like, it all looks messy from the outside right now. And we can all laugh at it, but like, we have to be part of this fight if we want to stop it. This is the most winnable and consequential fight yet of this presidency, and every single person has to stand up and speak out for it, because that's the only way we're going to stop it.
So, but do you imagine something where we think we got him and then he gets out again? Like he somehow...
A couple times.
It's not Breaking Bad. I mean, maybe. I mean, I don't know. I mean, so we have to fight it. It's really hard to pass legislation. We're protected by the institutions of our government still. Is there a chance we think we have them in our grasp and he slips through our fingers? Yeah, sure. And then, I don't know. But
well, look, there's also, if nothing passes... the Trump administration would need to shore up some of these markets where some of these insurers have been leaving anyway. We're leaving the last year of the Obama administration, which is a very fixable thing. You just, you provide some more subsidies. You make sure that people buy health insurance with the mandate. So you can make it work. They can decide if nothing passes, we're going to let it not fail, but we're going to make sure it doesn't work and then try to blame the Democrats. So like that very well could happen.
It could happen. So you feel it's going to fail at this point?
At this point, it doesn't look too good. But I, like I said, I think it is up to
people. We're out of the prediction business.
Yeah.
You're not going to
win. Hillary is absolutely going to win.
It's up to us.
Wiretapping. How do you feel about it?
Not for it.
What part of that?
Well, Tommy's the one. He put on a pair of overalls and a black hat. Went into Trump Tower. Opened that microwave door.
What do you make of it? I mean, this is...
Got in there with the wires. Tommy sees it all. It's a lot of ice cream. It's a lot of ice cream and yelling at the TV, frankly. I don't know what people are so worked up about.
What do you think about?
I mean, the broader story, I think, of Trump's crazy wiretapping tweet is something we've been watching for a while, which is he consumes not media, but conspiracy theories, whether it's Breitbart or some random guy who tweets that 3 million people voted illegally in California, and then he regurgitates it to the masses, right? And so I don't think he understands what a FISA court is. I don't think he understands what wiretapping really means. It may be the case that there was some collection of information regarding contact from a server to the Russian bank, like that's something we're reading about. But the President of the United States cannot order the wiretapping of an American citizen, period. That's because of reforms after Nixon, because he did that against his political opponents. To just blindly accuse, to just wake up Saturday morning pissed off at the world and tweet that the former President of the United States wiretapped you, is so monumentally insane.
Where do you think it's coming from? Because a lot of people do think it's all calculated.
I mean, I think his father wasn't very loving. and I think he has a chip
on his
shoulder
about
that.
Not enough hugging his
children. Right, and I think he struggles with a lack of self-worth, so he kind of... So he inflates his own sense of ego, but at the end of the day, he hates himself the most. And so there's no amount of attention and praise that can fix that problem.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a vicious circle. Yeah. So he gets angry.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Okay, that was good.
That was a softball. That's one of he was like, here it comes.
I was waiting for self-hating homosexual in there, and I was like, let's go there.
No, I don't like myself, but I love being gay.
Okay.
I mean, I think he has advisors around him, like Steve Bannon,
yeah,
who is feeding him this bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And the most frustrating part of this is, like, he controls the entire intelligence apparatus of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
He has the coolest job in the world. He could ask for any piece of information at any time, whenever he wanted it. He doesn't do that because he's not intellectually curious.
The answer is out there. Yeah. He can find the answer.
Who killed JFK?
The best thing they said, yeah, like, the
what's happening at Area 51?
Right.
The moon landing. Right. Did it actually happen? Right. No.
Who killed Biggie?
You know, what?
the idea that they're like, okay, to prove this claim, we're going to ask Congress to investigate the executive branch. Who runs the executive branch?
Today they're blaming it on, they're like, oh, it was air quotes. Right. Tap.
Yeah.
Are you
unbelievable?
What do you think about that, the reaction? Why don't they just stop?
That's the most important thing, too.
Right.
Like, Donald Trump is going to do what Donald Trump is. He's in a new and strange house, but he's behaving in the exact same way. Like, mm-hmm. He's just going through the motions.
Mm-hmm.
What is so dispiriting, what's so heartbreaking, what's so enraging, what makes this so painful is he is defended by people who know better on the Hill, who mm-hmm. have refused to hold him accountable. And he has people around him, people like Sean Spicer, Kellyanne Conway, Reince Priebus, who have given up any semblance of their integrity to create a way to make Trump not look bad. So like Sean Spicer says, we're going to release a statement, we're going to get Congress to investigate. That is all just a way to deal with the fact that the president is a jackass
mm-hmm.
and lying and horrible. And they know it, and they're selling their souls to defend him.
And why?
I don't know. Ambition.
Right.
Not thinking it through.
Fear.
Fear.
Fear of the these people make decisions because their base is all worked up, or they think that the Republican base is all worked up because they are, you know, incited every day by the Sean Hannitys of the world mm-hmm. and the Breitbarts. And so these people get spun up, and then the politicians are like, well, we can't go against the base because then we'll be attacked by Breitbart. It's all fear of losing their job.
And we were talking about this a little backstage. I mean, you see all these tech companies sort of dipping their toe and being a part of sort mm-hmm. of advisory panels. I think that's an incredibly bad idea.
Right.
Because I think if you put your lot in with Donald Trump, you're going to own a lot of the shit he does, even mm-hmm. if you think you can distance yourself from that specific thing.
So we're all in Trump University now.
Mm-hmm. We want our money back.
Yeah. You're learning a lot?
Yeah.
You like your teachers?
There is a feeling, though, that it's part of a bigger master plan, that it's all the chaos and mania is...
I mean, I think
all
like
manufactured.
Nationalism is not that hard. It's not that hard to incite people against another. And this is the harder Democrats have. The challenge Democrats have all the time is like, we believe in governing and governance and, you know, trying to find middle ground. Steve Bannon's stated purpose is he's a Leninist and he wants to burn the thing down. So maybe that's the master plan. I'm not ascribing a lot of brain wattage behind sort of the daily execution of that plan.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they have all the levers of government, so they should be able
to do
something.
That is the exact point, right? I mean, it is so much easier to burn down a barn than to, you know, make people believe that government can work for them. That is the harder challenge.
Right.
And so no matter what happens, we will always have the more difficult challenge because government screws up a lot of times
and it
leaves people behind. And so, like, it's not perfect. And for Bannon and for Trump, it's not genius to say all your problems, you can blame it on this person that doesn't look like you, or you can blame it on politicians, or you can blame it on that. That is super easy.
And that's why Barack Obama, maybe the maddest he ever was when healthcare.gov didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Because
he
had been trying to talk about, like on the campaign in 2007-08, he would talk about making government cool again, right? Because all politicians run it down and criticize it, and rightly so in a lot of instances. But like, there's some basic competence and some basic need there for a lot of people. And when that didn't work, that infuriated him because it undercut the faith in
Absolutely.
The thing we're trying to build.
It was astonishing. Yeah. It was astonishing that Tinder works every day and they couldn't get its website to work. I actually said that on Meet the Press. It was like a group of white guys and me on Meet the Press.
Sounds familiar.
Which was very exciting for me. And I said, you know, Tinder works every day. And they're like, are you comparing, you know, healthcare to Tinder? I go, no, Tinder works. You can get fucked easily. So no.
David Bergen, over to you.
Yeah. I think it was one of those guys. They all look the same to me.
This is Pod Save America. Stick around. There's more great show coming your way.
I'm Roman Mars, host of 99% Invisible. I love the book, The Power Broker, the epic biography of former New York City planner Robert Moses. So I'm breaking it down 100 pages at a time and talking to special guests about why this book matters, like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I actually think if it wasn't for Robert Moses, I probably wouldn't have run for Congress.
Listen to 99% Invisible's breakdown of The Power Broker every month on the 99% Invisible podcast feed.
You can live out your MasterChef dreams when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Why are smart businesses graduating to NetSuite by Oracle? Because NetSuite eliminates the expense of multiple business systems by consolidating your operations together into one. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite reduces IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, so you can access it from anywhere. You cut the cost and headaches of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Bringing all your major business processes into one platform improves efficiency, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. You'll see how you'll profit with NetSuite too. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Just go to netsuite.com/podcast25 for more information. That's netsuite.com/podcast25.
When you think about this administration, so are you scared or are you just like, what a fucking goat rodeo this is?
Both. I'm scared sometimes.
Why is that? Why? If it seems like it's out of control. I don't think
because
it is.
Because right now, the world is a relatively stable place right now, at least the United States is. And I am very worried. I mean, it's all fun and games now. We can make fun of them for wiretapping and all this other kind of these crazy conspiracy theories. But when a crisis hits, I don't know how he's going to react, but I don't think it's going to be well. And so that's what keeps me up.
I mean, I was on the national security staff. Yeah. I was a low-level 2-bit spokesman, but I sat in a lot of meetings where I saw very serious people making decisions. And so I understand that, like, the work that you have to do to, like, manage in North Korea is ongoing and constant, and it requires pushing the government and bringing them together and working these problems every day. I have no sense that that's happening. You add to what John said, like, when Barack Obama, when Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab tried to blow up a plane over Detroit, or you know, when any of the various sort of crises hit, whether it was a domestic shooting or a terrorist attack, he first and foremost viewed his role as sort of talking about the resilience of the United States and, like, bringing people down and making sure there wasn't hysteria and, you know, turning on each other. I do not think that will be Donald Trump's instinct. I do not think that will be Steve Bannon's instinct. I think they will see a political opportunity.
Also, like, when Obama walked into office, there's this economic crisis, right? No one wanted to take a vote for the financial bailout. No one wanted to take a vote for the auto bailout. But Obama, Democrats, and some Republicans came together to do that, knowing that it was going to be unpopular because they knew that if they did not do that, the economy would have collapsed and the global economy could have collapsed with it. That took some political courage. I could not see this Congress and this president taking those same
steps. Are there any Republicans? John, which ones do you like?
I think Ben Sasse is really interesting and has had some integrity.
Justin Amash.
I mean, man, some people that I would not expect to like. It's not that hard. It's like, so Seth Moulton, right? Democrat, we had him on the show yesterday, and he was saying that in the House, he goes to the House gym and he works out with a bunch of Republicans. And when they're in the gym and they're talking, they all know how crazy Donald Trump is. They all know what he's doing is wrong. And then they put their suits on and they go out to the podium and they lie. And it's not that hard to show integrity in this moment, and there are very few who have done it.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, John McCain's been running the Maverick play longer than, like, Stockton Malone ran the pick and roll, right? Like, it's like every time the reporter's like, oh, my God, he spoke out. So, I mean, I do think there's some value in what they're saying. I'd love to see them, like, push a little harder here.
Right. Because him and Lindsey Graham have an act going.
They have an act, and they have a shtick, and it worked very well.
Statler and Waldorf.
Exactly.
What'd you say?
Statler and Waldorf from The Muppets.
Oh.
I hate this.
I've been impressed with, like, there's a lot of political operatives that are Republicans who've sort of spoken out and decided this is not going to be my, you know, whether it's like Nicole Wallace or Tim Miller or Stuart Stevens or Mike Murphy, a lot of these folks who were Romney people, Bush people. But it's funny, when you get to elected office and you actually, you see fewer, you don't see as much of that.
You see a lot more Marco Rubio.
I want to finish up on the media itself, and then we'll get to some questions. We have a whole bunch of questions, just 1 or 2 minutes on that. How do you look at how the media has performed here in general? The general, and there's lots of different, there's print media, but it's all pretty much the same. How do you look about how it happened? Because a year and a half ago, I was meeting with I was at a party, and there was all campaign reporters from the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and they were all treating Trump like a circus act. They were like, oh, he's nothing. And I was like, he's kind of interesting, don't you think? Like, I like Make America Great. Oh, you don't know what you're talking about. The powers that be will not let Trump win. And I said, are they going to shoot him? Because otherwise, I don't see how they can stop him, because he's really appealing.
Yeah.
And it was sort of a total missing in action kind of thing. Do you think they have recovered that now?
I've learned not to lump the media all in together.
Yeah.
That's one thing I've been trying not to do. I think journalists, people who go out and do reporting, have done an outstanding job, and they've been doing an even better job in the Trump era. I think that political analysis is still as broken as it ever has been.
A raging dumpster fire filled with idiots and just campaign rejects and valueless creeps. A bunch of TV-hungry maniacs.
That's why we're starting a media company. To John's point, like, I think there were decisions made early on. I want to be more careful about this, too, because, like, I feel like we're doing careful now.
Nuance.
13 minutes left, nuance. We were very critical of the media. I think it's important to talk about, like, what the criticism was. A lot of it was cable news, and a lot of it was business decisions made by top people to show Trump constantly, while their reporters...
I mean, now, though. Now, do you think they're...
I think they're a hell of a lot tougher on him now than they were before.
I still think it's a dumpster fire.
No, I in terms of...
The reporters, I think,
the reporters are doing a good job.
Like, if you look at Jake Tapper, like, he's doing tough journalism every day.
Yeah, he is, actually.
I think that what happened in the run-up to the election, I think that there was this presumption that Hillary Clinton would be the next president. Mm-hmm. So they treated her like someone to be held accountable to being president, and they treated Trump like a TV show a little bit. I mean, I will always remember the New York Times. Remember the New York Times on the day that they had 4 or 5 email stories that blanketed the front page.
Yeah.
It was about the letter. It was about Comey's letter. There was no allegation. There was no proof. There was no nothing. It led the entire New York Times a week before the election. And then the night before the election, when Comey said, no, just kidding. By the way, just kidding. Nothing was wrong here. She's fine. NBC Nightly News led with Hillary Clinton avoids email controversy on final day. Okay. That was
Which
it.
Is... Wait, did she?
that was a bit.
What were we talking about?
Okay.
Can you guys see my hand motion?
The media.
Oh, yeah, the media.
Dumpster fire.
Yeah. I think that they've been chastened. I think that one thing that they've been learning how to do is how do you deal with the fact that the president's a liar and that you can't just report his accusations. There are bright spots and failures. But, I think that we have a problem of... The conversation around politics is broken. The journalism is excellent.
But there's also, like, there's one of the things we think about constantly is, like, people are getting information in different ways. Like, I think if you're betting on cable news being the primary way of people getting political news in 10 years, you're crazy, right? So we're trying to figure out how to reach people entirely mobily. I think a podcast is a part of that. But I think, like, what the Snapchat folks are doing, Good Luck America with Peter Hamby, like, if you're not thinking about these people who aren't Googling Barack Obama or going to nytimes.com, but how to reach them where they are, you're not going to be communicating with the people you need to reach.
And if we don't figure out a way to reach them, then
our
fake news, the hoaxes are going to reach them.
Yeah.
Right? They're
going
to get it on their Facebook feed.
So you have a John Lovett filter on Snapchat now?
That's BD. Let's talk about that after. That's an idea.
All right, let's get to some questions. Let's see. What do you think of what is happening in France right now with the rise of the far right wing, Marie Le Pen, and various people?
It's scary, and it's weird. It's weird the convergence of rhetoric and that you know, you see like Nigel Farage and Steve Bannon and Marie Le Pen like meeting, having conversations. I think Europe, we should be nervous about Europe for a couple of reasons. I think they are susceptible to some of the fake news, like Russian hacking things we saw that were so pervasive in our election. I think that's something they're sort of sounding the alarm on, rightly so. I think that they've dealt with, look, we're really lucky to have two big oceans on either side of our country, right? Mm-hmm. And we have like very safe, steady borders. They do not. And what has happened in Syria and Iraq in terms of the refugee crisis has been disruptive, and it's adding on to a problem of a failure to assimilate communities together and people feeling disaffected and unemployed and dealing with economic problems as well. So I think, you know, it makes me very nervous about the ability of nationalism to really work and to push someone like her with some pretty abhorrent views into
office. Frankly, it's an easier sell in Europe than it is here.
Yeah.
It happened here.
And in the Dutch or another country.
Yeah. Steve King's favorite guy.
Yeah. It's fascinating that Germany is sort of the bulwark against alt-right.
Yeah. I mean, thank God for Angela Merkel. And
Angela. All right. What are your plans to give Crooked Media a more diverse voice? I would agree with that. You all somewhat look the same.
Us too.
Yeah.
I was told that being gay doesn't count.
No, it doesn't count. No more.
It used to.
It's like trying to get into nursery schools in San Francisco. It used to be easy, but now there's too many gays with children.
Kara Swisher, too many gays with children.
That's why Pence doing like an anti-gay EO would be like bittersweet.
Yes, exactly.
We get a little bit of that vibe back.
Yes, we do. I know.
I don't want that to happen.
So pleasurable for it to come back.
This is something we talk about and think about a lot because it's important to us for a number of reasons. It's important to us because we know we have blind spots when you're like literally same looking, same age, same work background, and we're missing perspectives, and we're trying to create a company that's going to reach a whole universe of people. I think, so we're working on diversifying our team internally as we start to hire people. I mean, we're a 2-month-old company, right? So we haven't like made a lot of decisions yet, but that's very, very, very important to us.
Right. Have more podcasts of more diversity.
And we're trying to recruit people to join Crooked Media that have diverse perspectives, diverse voices, and are coming from different backgrounds than us and different views. Because, you know, I think a year from now, I don't think this is a company that's like set up for us to talk. I think it's a setup, it's a company that's like brought together really smart, interesting people to have a better conversation about politics. And we might not be a part of a lot of those conversations.
Yeah, we don't want it to be built just around us.
No,
and I think we want diversity of background, diversity of viewpoints, diversity of life experience. Like that is incredibly important to this company, and it's what we're thinking about as we go beyond just the three of us, which it is right now.
Which company we started because we're friends.
I had ranked you, remember? Backstage I had ranked them. I said, here are the left wing
douche bros.
Yes, I said douche bros. And then I said, compared to the tech douche bros, compared to the right wing douche bros, you know, there's a list. And you said, where are we on the list? I said, oh, you're at the top, but it's really low bar.
We'll take it.
But
I'm sorry I missed that conversation.
I know, you did.
Yeah, you should have played.
It was delightful.
But meaning that you would have shows that are, how do you look at it? Because you don't want to just like fill in slots, but what is the thinking behind that?
No, for one, it's like, it's not filling slots. That's not how we think about it at all. It's like bringing people to the table as partners to help make every single decision and who are diverse in perspective and background and like understand things we don't know. So that's part of it. But then, I mean, our first show is with friends like these, with Anna Marie Cox. You should all subscribe on iTunes. That's great.
Right.
Her show is about bringing people who disagree together and bridging divides.
Right, right.
So it's the content and the individual.
Yeah.
And she's done it a couple of different ways. Like her first episode was she interviewed a pastor who both of his counties in Wisconsin voted for Trump. So she got that. And then, you know, she then had a great interview with a friend. And the whole episode was being the black friend.
Oh.
That was her second episode. So she's doing a great thing because she's like, I don't just want ideological partisan differences, but differences across race and religion and having all these uncomfortable conversations. Which
right.
is
great. It's sort of your family Thanksgiving dinner, essentially.
Exactly.
This past year. All right. U.S. has never been as ripe for tyranny. Could it be a gift that Trump pulls comfortable people back to reality and to care, as in external uniting threat? There is this whole meme that, you know, he's going to be King Trump. Do you think that? Do you feel that? Or do you think it's just being used to scare people?
I think that it's first of all, it's really hard to predict. I think being afraid that he's going to become an authoritarian, a full authoritarian. I think it's more effective and more practical to think, what can I do to protect institutions right now? Because if at the end of the day, Trump leaves office as a bitter president who undermined a bunch of our institutions and changed the presidency in a bunch of negative ways, that's still just terrible.
Yeah.
And the other thing to keep in mind, you know, Trump gives this joint address to Congress, right? And of course, a group of people that I've criticized lightly during this event say, he became president, he's finally president, you know, he's presidential now. Well, what does that mean? What that means is he walked, he gave the speech, he succeeded, he didn't fall down. He had the pomp and ceremony of being the president of the United States. He gets those cultural institutions, he gets those norms, we have given them to him. So we have to protect the ones that aren't as fun, like the oversight and the rule of law. Yeah. And I think that has to be our focus, you know, worrying that he's going to become...
In the courts.
Yeah. He can be very, very destructive long before he's Putin.
Right.
I do a foreign policy show called Pod Save the World. You can also...
We're just hitting all of our marks.
And all our bases here. Well, like, I was talking to a guy named Mike McFaul, who's a former U.S. ambassador to Russia, and I asked him a similar question. And people who are Russia experts, like Julie Yaffe, was sort of pointing out similar things. There are parallels, and I think what... The tail of the tape on sort of Putin's rise is that people didn't fight hard enough early, especially when it comes to defending the press, which is why I think we're pretty hard on
the judges. Now, apparently, the Congressional Budget Office needs protecting.
U.S. attorneys. Right. Yeah. I mean, right. Every nonpartisan institution that he doesn't like, he's savaging. But I think it is important to fight these things early. And, like, I don't know that that's a blessing in disguise, but a more awake population, that's probably a good thing.
So next question. Did Hillary lose because of policy, personality, or Putin?
Yes.
Yeah. Which one?
Yes.
You got to pick one.
I don't know if I can. I don't know if policy should go there. I don't think there was a policy that. I think. Look, the Putin thing is hard to. It's hard to tell what kind of effect that had. It's hard to measure it, but clearly, like the combination of WikiLeaks. I think Comey probably had a bigger effect on the undecided voters at the end. Is that? Yeah, that's Putin.
Yeah.
I think that had done. But that said, I think that Hillary was in a position to have Comey tip the race because she probably was. I think she was a candidate who'd been in who's of Washington, right? And that's not just a specific Hillary problem. Like, I was on the Kerry race in 2004. That was my first race. John Kerry had that same problem. Like, people who have been in Washington a very long time tend to be a little stiffer and a little more cautious when they're out on the campaign trail. It's not just specific to Hillary. Bernie was actually an exception. Bernie's been in Washington for I don't know how long.
Yeah, exactly.
He didn't seem like he was Washington.
No.
You know, he still sort of broke out of that.
No.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Putin, personality.
Go for it.
I was going to say that, you know, look, on the policy front, I think one lesson I take away from the election is, you know, there was a lot of like, look how thick this policy proposal is. And you know, you look at the proposals on minimum wage or college, and you took simple, elegant Bernie Sanders ideas. And it's not about left versus right, but just simple, digestible ideas that said, like, this is going to help you. It's simple. It's for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a Democratic apparatus that treated seriousness with how complicated it was, how you can massage the tax credits to not hurt the deficit in a certain kind of way. And I think that's the kind of thinking we need to push aside, because we're in the wilderness, we're an opposition party. We need to have simple, clear proposals.
Right. I think it's very frustrating.
Clear proposals.
Whatever he said, yeah.
Simple, clear proposals. The rare applause line.
That's not very Hamiltonian. But
I feel bad for my friends who worked on that campaign, because they sort of get called sore losers when they talk about the Putin. But as like a guy who's worked on a campaign comms team, you can't underestimate like the damage that did to the mood music of the election. Like, every day you're dealing with Putin or John Podesta's emails or whatever the hell it is, and you cannot get a message out that's hard to get out anyway. So, like, I don't discount that. I think what we screwed up and what I personally screwed up as a Democrat was clearly the rise of Bernie said, we hate Washington. The rise of Trump said, we hate Washington. And we said, here's a fixture of Washington for 30 years.
Yeah.
Right? And, like, voters said, no. That's not what we want. And I don't think that's personality. I don't think that's policy. I don't think it's Putin. I think it's a fundamental misreading by Democrats of like what people wanted.
And some of that was set before the election even began.
Even if you
think she ran a great campaign, you know, like it was just sort
and
of baked in.
She 3 million more votes, 100,000 votes go the other way. We're having a very different conversation.
Oh, stop.
It's worth pointing out. It's worth pointing out.
No, it is pointing out, but we always point it out. That's
I don't always point it out. Well, I rarely do. I forgot for a long time.
But the thing is, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. That's the thing about the Putin. It doesn't matter. We have to learn the lesson.
That's a lot of that.
Yeah, I know. I'm not.
Do that. If only.
Oh, so close.
Yeah. It was 30
people. Well, I'd say like, right. She almost became president. We almost weren't in a nightmare.
Hey, how's it going?
Yet not. All right, last question.
What's happening?
We're just talking.
Oh, cool.
Last quick question, and then I want you each to answer this and then say who, if you could pick almost any Democrat, anyone in the world who would pick to run in 2020, who would it be? It says, Cory Booker wasn't on your list of promising Dems. What's your thinking? That's the last question.
You know, this is why
who
these
would
lists
be
suck.
If you could pick
like, who would be? What?
You always leave someone off a list.
Yeah.
You know who
you
I
left
forgot?
Him off.
That you know who I forgot that I really like? Deval Patrick.
Oh, yeah.
I could see Deval coming out.
Okay.
I like Deval Patrick. Right. I like Deval Patrick.
All right. But anyone, think of someone completely out of, you could just pull, grab someone from anywhere. Business, Hollywood, anywhere.
Living or dead?
Yeah, living or dead. Okay, good.
Barack Obama?
No, he can't do it.
I don't think it's going to be fruitful. I don't think we're going to want to pick somebody. I think you're going to be unhappy with this as the last question.
All right. What would you like for the last question?
I don't know.
No, answer my fucking question.
That this is a tough interview.
It's super hard for a lesbian to beat a gay guy. It really is. Yes, now you did that.
We just have a natural rapport.
Yes, you did the thing.
I mean, look, we come from two different worlds,
right. What you guys missed is there was an email chain where Kara told Lovett she didn't think he was funny, so the result is a lot of right or wrong.
No, I said he was passively funny. That was different.
Right, and you...
Which really, that's...
Going on my Twitter profile.
You posted...
Momentarily.
Right. I did it because I knew the adverb would bother him. So pick one person. We got to go.
I'm picking Deval Patrick.
Deval Patrick. Anyone from history.
So annoying that he thought of Deval.
I mean,
we want to say Deval.
I'd like to see Elizabeth Warren run.
Elizabeth Warren, really. Elizabeth Warren. Yeah?
Yeah. Elizabeth Warren, Deval Patrick, those are my choices.
I'd like to see the Elizabeth Warren that...
Come on, do an original one, love.
Willing
it.
To let it rip and say whatever she feels.
An original one? Who do I have... Oprah. What are we even doing? I'm not into the secret thing. I'm sorry. That was some dangerous nonsense. If you wish it, you can be a billionaire like me. Where are they? Where are the Oprah billionaires?
All right, to not Oprah, Elizabeth Warren.
You want me to come up with somebody new?
Yes, I do. It's not that hard.
Give me some options.
Michelle.
Al Franken. Al Franken. I love Al Franken. I love Al Franken. I have loved Al Franken forever.
All right, I'm going with Jennifer Lawrence because everybody likes her.
Oh, great.
Good lesbian answer.
Exactly.
And
now,
with that...
the lesbian answer is Kristen Stewart because they want to...
You're just trying to get her.
Yeah, exactly. We just want her to hit us.
Yeah.
Like that. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Crooked Media.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
And that was our episode.
Wow.
Wasn't that great?
What a live show.
Incredible.
We learned things. We came away differently.
We didn't embarrass ourselves too much. At least none that we saw publicly.
Nope. Yeah, I mean, look, you know, the one thing that doesn't come across in the audio is how many people came up to us to say that they were friends of the pod.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Stop. What's the,
which was cool.
That's great. We had a good time. Anyway, go subscribe to Pod Save America. Get your friends to subscribe. Take their phone. Subscribe. Write reviews. Remember, we need all this. Remember.
Subscribe right now to Love It or Leave It, my new show. John is going to be a guest on the first episode.
That's enough reason to subscribe right there. Also, subscribe to Pod Save the World. There's a great Glenn Greenwald interview. Everyone's talking about it. And, of course, subscribe to Anna Marie Cox's podcast with friends like these. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
I'm Roman Mars, host of 99% Invisible. I love the book, The Power Broker, the epic biography of former New York City planner Robert Moses. So I'm breaking it down 100 pages at a time and talking to special guests about why this book matters, like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I actually think if it wasn't for Robert Moses, I probably wouldn't have run for Congress.
Listen to 99% Invisible's breakdown of The Power Broker every month on the 99% Invisible podcast feed.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.